install is going to join us by phone later.
Yeah, about 9:20.
9:20. And Director Demarest, do we know if he is going to be here or not?
No, he hadn't said anything.
So do we have quorum at 3?
We have 5, yes.
You're good. Okay. All right. So looking at the minutes of the last board meeting, any comments, questions?
I have one suggested change to section B5 regarding the adoption of Senate Bill 1040, Employer Program Rules. Mm-hmm. My concern is the way the draft minutes are written, someone could interpret that the board did not adopt all the changes in the Oregon administrative rules as presented. So my suggestion would be toward the end, we'd have a motion was made to adopt the employer program rules as presented rather than discrete portions of the employer program rules.
Sure.
That sounds good, and Katie will make the changes. Any interest in approving minutes?
I would make a motion to approve the minutes as revised.
Seconded.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 So moved. Director Olenek.
Thank you, Chair Shenoy, board members. For the record, Kevin Olenek, Director Purs. And welcome to our 2020 series of meetings. I'd love to do the Barbara Walters. This is 2020. We have a very interesting agenda to work through this morning, and we're very pleased to be able to provide the board with both a paper-based as well as a digital agenda. This is our first time working with our new board package, and we believe it's going to be a really positive move. It's much more effective and efficient in being able to provide the board members with the information, and it saves a lot of time in the back end for Katie going through and building out the board packages. So it's very much a move in the right direction, and beginning in March, we'll no longer be providing the board the paper packets, so we're pleased with that. We quit buying tabs. Substantive cost savings there. With respect to the director's report, again, always trying to highlight things that aren't covered through the typical agenda items, and it gives us an opportunity to show to the board and to the stakeholders that we're doing more than just what's covered in the agenda materials. Forward-looking calendar, we have those same 2020 dates, and again, the 9 o'clock start. If you have any concerns with any of the dates for the rest of the year, please let us know. With respect to item A2B, the OPERF investment report, preliminary earnings for year show regular account earnings of 13.56%, which is great. In agenda item C6, Milliman will be providing the preliminary estimates of the impact of the full-year returns exceeding our 7.2% assumed rate. A couple notes with respect to the Oregon Investment Council. They had their meeting yesterday, and at that meeting, Rukiah Adams stepped down as chair of the Oregon Investment Council, and I'd like to publicly acknowledge the work that she did over her 7 years with the Oregon Investment Council. John Russell, who was the vice chair, moved up to the chair position, and Rex Kim is now the vice chair. And it looks like in the February session upcoming that there will be a replacement that's up for consideration and from the Senate. So a bit of change to the Oregon Investment Council board makeup there.
Yeah. If I may add, Rukiah Adams is an absolutely amazing leader. She is very unique in her style, and it has been really a pleasure for me to work with her on OIC's board. So I want to thank her for her service as well. Also, John Russell, we meet fairly frequently, talk about risks and this and, you know, other related business. And he's very, very capable, so I'm looking forward to working with him as well.
Yes. So I thought that would be good to note. With regard to the budget execution report, we've now closed out the 2017-19 biennium, and there was a positive variance of about $6.4 million, or about 6.3% of the operational budget. We're 6 months into this current biennium, and as of this time, we're projecting a positive variance of about $1.1 million. Other items to note, Stephanie Vaughn will be going through some administrative rules and will be speaking to the adoption of two rules. Marjorie Taylor will be providing the 2020 legislative session preview, as well as providing an overview of some of the legislative concepts that we, the agency, are considering for the 2021 session. Yvette and Mary Michelle will be providing reports with respect to Senate Bill 1049, and Yvette will also be wrapping up the IPTDF project. And as well, Amanda Marble will be presenting for the board's consideration the 2019 preliminary earnings. And last but not least, Fine Friends from Milliman will be presenting the estimates or the reflections on the earnings in a very concise way. Probably the smallest slide deck I've seen in the 18 months I've been here, so it will be a short meeting. With that, any questions from the board?
Director Olenek, maybe this is a question for Greg, but I noticed in the budget report that the estimated total expenditures for health insurance for the 2019-21 biennial summary are like about $75 million less than the 17-19 summary. You know the reason for that decrease?
I do not at this time. So we'll find the answer out and have Greg respond to you.
Thank you.
Sorry about that.
But Director Damaris, I was looking at the health insurance part, and I noticed that we have been spending about a third of what the allocated budget is. And I was talking to Director Olenek about that this morning, and we just have to look into why there is that much disparity in the actual versus the budgeted.
I believe part of it is due to the fact that we're, from the contractual side, we're moving from the minimum premium contracts to the full cost contracts, and there might be some of those reserves in that we had set up and didn't get expended because of the move, but I'll make sure we get that answer to you so that everybody's aware of why there is that substantive change.
Oh, okay, so it's possible that those reserves are being counted against. Okay, got it. Thank you.
And I had a question for the 1921 operating budget. There's an item that says the agency has $525,000 in unscheduled expenditure limitation related to Package 106. And Package 106 is, I think, the risk management package?
Yes, Chair Shinoy, that's correct. Within our budget that was approved, there is a sum of money for information security and continuity management. And what we needed to do is go through is to send documentation to the Legislative Fiscal Office to prove that we are following best practices or have established best practices programs for both information security and continuity management. We're still awaiting the review of those documents so those funds can be fully scheduled and brought into our budget. We did get a portion of it approved and scheduled such that we could start to do some work with respect to protecting our data. And so we're hopeful that within the next month or two, we will get those full funds scheduled so that we can continue on with our information security and continuity management programs.
Any other questions? Okay. Mr. Stanley?
Thank you, Chair Shinoy and members of the board. Jason Stanley, Chief Compliance Audit and Risk Officer. The Oregon Accounting Manual requires board involvement in approving the director's expenses during the year. One option is to actually approve them throughout the year, which isn't very practical. The other is to delegate that responsibility to other senior management. That has been updated and is in your packet. Those responsibilities fall on myself and the deputy director. When we do that, we do need to report once a year on the expenditures. We provided a more detailed report at the December audit committee meeting for the audit committee, but we need to get that in front of the full board and make sure it gets into the minutes that that's been completed. There was really nothing of note during the year. $257,671 was spent on all aspects of the director's expenses, from payroll, other payroll expenditures, and other purchases, travel, those kinds of things. Nothing out of the ordinary, but I just want to get on the record and answer any questions that you might have. Okay.
Thank you so much. Mr. Stanley, did we need a motion to approve the delegation to?
You've already approved it, but I don't know if that you did.
I would say formalizing it first.
Great, thank you. Okay, so we need to have a motion to, let's see, the specific words will be. To delegate the review and approval process for the executive director's financial transactions to the first deputy director or the chief compliance officer.
I'd make a motion to that effect.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
So moved. Thank you for bringing that up, Director Buckley.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. For the record, Stephanie Vaughn with PERS. We begin with item B1, which is adoption of our pre-retirement death benefit rules. The amendment to these rules implement the provisions of House Bill 2417 from the 2019 session, which provides a new alternative pre-retirement death benefit to surviving spouses of Tier 1 and Tier 2 members. The amendments to the rule outline the procedure and the timeline within which the surviving spouse must make the election. And at the December board meeting, when we were talking about the timelines and such and reporting of the deaths, the board had a question about employers reporting deaths and whether that was required. And we looked into that, and the employers are reporting that death as part of their regular reporting. They do it electronically through the regular reporting process. So if a member is active when they die, that should be reported by the employer to PERS. We had no public comment on the rule, and we've made no changes to the rule since notice, so we're seeking a motion to adopt the rule as presented.
Any questions on this one?
Make a motion to adopt the rule as presented.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
So moved.
Item B2 is our work after retirement rules. These were first noticed to the board in October, and those edits implement the provisions, the work after retirement provisions of Senate Bill 1049. Through implementation, we recognized that we needed to address a concern regarding early retirees and the need for a bona fide retirement. So in December, we did a first reading, and we added provisions relating to early retirees that now require them to have a six-month break in service from all participating employers. If they do not have such a break, they are subject to the current limits of 1,040 hours for Tier 1, Tier 2, and the 600 hours for the OPSERP members. The work after retirement provisions of 1049 were effective 1/1/2020, and we are still continuing to work on the finer implementation aspects of that provision. So we do have additional changes that we've made to the rules since the December board meeting. We've added clarification that the rate that will be applied to the retiree wages is the rate that for the particular member based on their tier and classification at retirement. And just yesterday we added, we posted one last clarification, and it is regarding pooled employers. If a pooled employer has an adjustment to their rate due to a transition liability, transition surplus, that rate will also apply to, or that adjustment will also apply to the rate that's applied to the retiree wages. We had two public comments on this rule, and those are addressed in the memo, but we did have some follow-up from Carol Samuels on her comment after the public comment period ended, and it was just a clarification. We misinterpreted her comment, so her comment was addressing the concern about the rate that's charged on the employer for the retiree, that it should be specific to the tier and classification. So it's actually addressed with the changes that we've made to the rule since the December board meeting. We're seeking a motion to adopt the last presented rule that was posted yesterday that includes the clarification for the transition liabilities and transition surpluses.
There's been a lot of discussion on this particular rule.
Yes.
So in summary, I think we are trying to talk about what bona fide separation is and allowing unlimited hours for all employers. All employees to work for PERS participating employers.
Correct. And we define the bona fide separation in the rule, but we only use it with regard to early retirees in the rule.
Okay.
So that's how we're applying it only to the early retirees, that definition currently.
Perfect. Thank you. Any questions?
Can I see if I understand the objection that was raised by counsel for the University of Oregon? There are certain employees in the university system that do not participate in PERS.
Correct.
And if those employees retire and return to work in the university system, the university will be required to make a pension contribution on that person to PERS, even though they are not a PERS retiree?
Chair Chenoy, Board Member Buckley. Actually, it's a little bit different. If a member is a vested member when they are hired by the university system, they have an option to either choose to participate in the optional retirement plan under the university system or continue to participate in PERS. So if they elect to participate in the optional retirement plan, they can choose to leave their account here or move it over to the ORP. Mm-hmm. If they leave their account here, they receive a retirement from PERS. So these are the specific individuals that are at issue. So they're a member of PERS. They keep their account here. They choose to participate in the ORP. When they retire, they receive a PERS benefit, and then if they go back to work for the university system, they are a PERS retiree, and those are the ones that will be charging them on the retiree wages for the employer contribution.
I understand. Thank you.
Any other questions? Any interest in adopting?
Chair Chenoy, I move that we adopt modifications to the work after requirement rules as presented.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
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 Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's get in there.
Good morning, Chair Chenoy, members of the board. For the record, I'm Marjorie Taylor, and I'm here with PERS. So Monday, the 2020 legislative session will begin, we believe. There's some quorum issues, as perhaps you've noticed in the media, may or may not happen. However, if they do, then they have to adjourn no later than March 8th, Sunday. In that time, we do not anticipate that PERS will be a topic of discussion as it has been in previous short and long sessions, so hooray for that. However, there are a few bills that I'd like to highlight that we've seen in the past several days, and I can explain a little bit about what we're doing with them. First of all, Senate Bill 1522 is relating to education. Therefore, it's a broad relating clause that can accommodate a number of amendments if the chair and the committee members are interested in continuing conversations. So a lobbyist has picked up Senate Bill 634 from the 2019 session. It is a bill that addresses charter schools and their OPSERP employees who live out of state, who may have been told that perhaps salary that they earned would be included in their benefit calculation, even though they live out of state. It's an issue that we resolved for the universities in a previous session, so we worked with this lobbyist, Marshall Koba, over time last session to resolve issues in Senate Bill 634. That bill didn't pass in 2019. So again, he's seeking an amendment to 1522 that will just insert 634 into that bill. We do have a copy of that amendment. We anticipate that it will be discussed in committee on Tuesday, and we'll see by Thursday afternoon whether the committee will consider moving it forward. Senate Bill 1528 is the perennial tax reconnect bill that is introduced by the Legislative Revenue Office on an annual basis. We appreciate that they do that on our behalf. We are this morning working to understand whether we need a minor amendment to that bill, and we'll communicate with their office as quickly as possible if we do need an amendment based on provisions related to the SECURE Act, which was approved by Congress in December. So that hearing is scheduled for Tuesday morning. So again, in the event that we do need an amendment, we need to get that drafted as quickly as possible and get that moving in the right direction. Senate Bill 1576 is the Judicial Marshals, Police, and Fire Bill. This is a redraft of Senate Bill 187 from last session. This is brought this session by the judicial branch, just like it was last session. So this is one of their five priority bills. I'm not sure if they have five this session, but they had the opportunity to introduce five bills. So this bill would allow three employees of the judicial branch police and fire status as they provide these services to the judicial branch and all of their courthouses. This is not the first session that we've seen this bill. As I say, it's a redraft from 2019, and frankly, it's a redraft of previous bills in previous sessions. However, we've seen the concept evolve and the language evolve over time, and this is the best draft that we've seen. So in the event that it's scheduled for a public hearing Thursday morning at 8:30, we'll see if I go down. I understand there's a protest that's scheduled for 7 a.m. on Thursday morning with a number of trucks and people involved, so we'll see if we make it down there. The fourth and final bill that we really have our eyes on is House Bill 4108, which has to do with prison chaplains. There are some OPSERP prison chaplains who would like for the definition of salary to include their housing allowance. This is a redraft of a bill brought forth by Representative Gorsuch in the 19th session. That was House Bill 2646. It was heard in that House committee in 2019, but didn't move forward. So again, this is a redraft and reintroduction by Representative Gorsuch. At this time, we don't believe that it's scheduled. At least we haven't seen it on an agenda. We'll keep our eyes on that through next Friday, which is the deadline for any bill to be on an agenda for a work session out of the first chamber. There are certainly a couple other bills that we're keeping our eyes on just because of the broad nature and the broad impact to state agencies and or just operations in general. However, we'll see how things shake out between now and next Friday, again, which is the deadline. And then PERS has an opportunity to present our budget note as required in House Bill 5032. You'll hear more about that from Yvette. But right now, we anticipate making that presentation on Wednesday the 19th in front of the Information Management and Technology Committee. We are to make that presentation to the Ways and Means Committee also. However, they might have some other topics that they need to focus on rather than our budget note. We do also have two additional reports that we have to file with Ways and Means. One is already filed. One will be filed this afternoon. The first one is the preliminary earnings crediting. So after board action, we will report to Ways and Means exactly what you do in terms of preliminary earnings crediting. And then after the March meeting, we'll report to them what final earnings crediting will be. The second report is just our generic report on all of the employer programs. That report is prescribed in Senate Bill 1566, which was a topic of discussion during the 18 session. In that report, which you'll hear from Mary Michelle on, we'll report on the school district's unfunded liability fund, the employer incentive fund, and the UAL resolution program. From there, it's just a matter of watching what happens every day in Salem, hoping that everything goes smoothly for them. This is about the 16th year that we have had one or more legislative sessions, so I'm sure everybody involved is pretty tired of convening, but this is where we are. So the next topic of discussion will be agency legislative concepts for the 2021 session. In my memo, I've included some information that the agency is chewing on, and we wanted to expose publicly, not only to you, but obviously our employer and union stakeholders and the public, about some concepts that we're thinking of requesting have drafted for 21. I think we can have a more robust discussion about how far we're going with those concepts at our March board meeting, but obviously one of our major concerns is to address some technical fixes in Senate Bill 1049. And then there are some other proposals that are technical fixes for accumulated statutory changes that we've noticed over recent years to help us refine the way that we implement the plan that has been approved by our plan sponsors and kind of how the agency addresses implementation. So with that, I'd be happy to answer some questions.
I had a generic question. So when it comes to technical fixes for Senate Bill 1049,
sure.
How do you decide whether to go to the legislature with a new bill or then hand it over to Stephanie and Nate and say, make some rules, you know?
Right. Chair Shinoy, thank you very much for that question. So what I understand it to be is, at what time do we decide whether administrative rules will be in our best interest versus requesting a statutory fix, which is more impactful than an agency rule? First of all, we have to be delegated the authority to draft rules on the statute, and we have pretty broad authority to do that. However, it's also important to have that statutory guidance from our plan sponsors about how they want us to implement the plan, and there are times where perhaps some of that guidance is a little more political than perhaps the agency or the board wants to wade into. So there are times where that statutory guidance is rather important. But we, the agency, have to live and breathe with this plan on a daily basis, and there are times where administrative rules are more helpful to the agency as we can be a little more flexible in the rulemaking process with regard to implementation of what we understand the legislative intent to be. I hope that helps.
Okay. I have some questions, Chair. It's all right. Marjorie, your memo that's in the packet, the January 31st memo, says that the DAS is going to make a separate report to the legislature as well. On the budget bill, is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
You know when they're going to make that report, or when we can see it?
Sure, Chair Shinoy and Member Demarest. The budget note in House Bill 5032 requires DAS and PERS to report at the same time on the implementation of 1049. So we understand that they will be invited to the same information management and technology meeting on the 19th, and they had to submit their letter to the process, shall we call it, at the same time. So I don't know if we have a public copy of that letter, but you could certainly check in with DAS about what they have advised. But we've been partnering with them all along with regard to implementation, and again, I'm sure that Yvette can elaborate a little bit more on that.
Okay. My other question was about the 19th. That seems late.
Chair Shinoy and Member Demarest, actually, that's probably perfect timing.
Is it?
Because at that point, the Information Management and Technology Committee might need something to do. we'll be so far into session that all of the kind of quote-unquote chaos of the first couple of weeks of getting bills through that you want to move into the second part, all of that will be over. It'll be a little quieter maybe with regard to some of the policy bills, but obviously there will be some other political conversations going on in the building, you hope, at that time. But it's actually a good time. Okay. Rather be in the middle as opposed to the beginning, certainly not at the end.
And the last question, it's about the proposed concepts for 2021. I just want to make sure I'm understanding correctly. Is the agency proposing essentially a blanket ban on retirees working for within 6 months after retirement and maintaining the retiree status?
Chair Shenoy and Member Demarest, I'm sorry. No, we're not proposing any sort of ban for working after retirement.
You're talking about how there's a concept in here that all retirees be absent from service of all PERS participating employees during the first 6 months.
So, in fact, that is part of the administrative rule that you were just approving, and that has to do with the early retirees, as Stephanie had outlined, that right now a bona fide retirement means that we need to have that 6 month separation between the time you leave employment and the time that you're rehired by a PERS participating employer. So our current focus is on the early retirees, and we'll continue that conversation with our employers and members moving forward.
Got it. So the concept is not as broad as I was reading it.
No, okay. Please. No.
Okay.
No, we are not in the position to ban anything.
Okay.
We just want to clarify what we understand the regulations to be.
Thanks.
Member Demarest, there is attachment 3 to section C3, and that's a comprehensive report that was sent by DAS. I don't know whether it's exactly the one that is referred to here, but that was an interesting report to read.
It was. Yeah. It was. And I appreciate what appears to be the cooperation, I think, that you referred to also, Marjorie, between PERS and DAS. Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. For the record, Yvette Elledrodes, Deputy Director of PERS. My first board memo is addressing our target date fund implementation, and hopefully will be the last final presentation on the actual project. One thing to really note about this project was that it really intersected and was impacted by Senate Bill 1049. Some of the very tools that we were working hard to complete have to also be looked at to be updated for Senate Bill 1049. So we had to make some decisions about where are we going to draw the line so that we could begin implementation for Senate Bill 1049. So this project started back in 2017, and we've had some challenges in just really, we absorbed a lot of the work instead of getting additional resources or external resources. And in hindsight, that was not the way we should have done things, but here we are at. And I will say we have successfully deployed all of the tools that we needed to get the work done, and are moving forward. There have been, and in addition to that, there's been some changes where we, as I outlined, some of the newer activities have been the consolidation of the 2020 fund into the retirement allocation fund, as well as the addition of the 2065 fund. We've never done that before, so we worked very collaboratively with Treasury and Voya and AllianceBernstein to really outline all of the steps. And I want to say there were upwards of 30 steps to walk through
We still have a few more. But that was very successfully, you know, it's been going very successfully as well. And so a lot of moving parts in that area. So members should be able to see some of those things on their annual statements this year. So our budget had never really changed from the additional $200,000 that we were allocated. We did add on an additional $65,000 for one external resource just to tie up some loose ends. So budget-wise, this was a very low-cost project. However, the big impact was. So everything as far as critical tools and communications, that sort of thing, we have in process. The creation of the retirement installments fund has proved to be more as challenging as well on a couple different fronts. One is this was brought up about a year ago with Treasury about some discrepancies of understanding our earnings process and how that translated from their earnings to what we actually credited to our member accounts. So the creation of the retirement installment funds, this is just for installments, for retirees with installments. There's about 7,600 of those retirees. Should help with the volatility of those accounts. And we've even seen some members contacting us about the activity in 2019 because they've seen some volatility that they were not sure was correct or not. So we're really looking at how to communicate how installments are credited earnings. We had information on our website that probably wasn't very clear. So really looking at how to explain our processes, our administrative fees, how we credit earnings to installments as well. On the target date fund side, because this retirement installment fund is not going to be a target date fund, it won't be one that a member can choose. They will be invested in the short-term fund. On the other 10 target date funds, that we haven't had a lot of questions from members about that. So it really, more recently, has really focused on the retirement installment fund. That was effective on the first of the year, but our earnings are lagging. You know, we lag in our earnings crediting for members, so they actually aren't seeing that change until March. And I think that was also a little confusing based on our communication. If you were not at the Oregon Investment Council meeting yesterday, they did have a pretty thorough presentation on the update, on IAP update and the target date funds, the creation of the retirement installments fund, the performance, the glide path review, that sort of thing, and also the impact of member redirect and member choice on the IAP. So I think that's a good overview of the IAP at this time in relation to the impact of target date funds and as well as the legislation. So I'd encourage you to look at that, or if you want us to send you the link, we can do that. I found it helpful. So going forward on communications, we're really going to look at leveraging our annual statements that will be coming out this year to further help tie up all of this mystery about the IAP that our members continue to have. And when I talk about Senate Bill 1049, we have some other things planned as well. But that's about it. If you have any questions about Target Date Fund project, I'd be happy to answer them.
One comment is I think this is really an area in which you had to collaborate with so many different parties. You know, you had the Landsberg's team, you had OIC, you had, there was always a question of who gets to create a new TDF. So
that's right.
You know, I commend you on your successful navigation of all of these different steps. And I think I'm glad that sort of this is put to rest for a while now.
Right. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
I have a comment since Yvette, since you mentioned the OIC board meeting yesterday. It was there was a statement made during that meeting that the speaker thought the only legitimate reason for someone to move out of their assigned target date fund would be if they had other assets. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to say on the record of this meeting that another legitimate reason is if the individual's target retirement date is different than the one that's assumed for them.
Yes, Chair Shinoy, Board Member Demarest, that I think it's really on that individual's risk tolerance, where they're at in their career, and that's why the member choice implementation, that was what members wanted.
Thank you.
Thank you. My next board memo is an update on the Senate Bill 1049 implementation. When I wrote this, it was probably 3 weeks ago, so a lot has changed. So I have quite a few updates, and I'm happy to say a lot of progress has been made in that area.
I will say that it took me many cups of tea to go through this section. It is the amount of reporting that PERS has to do is just mind-boggling.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's surprising that anything gets done, right? It seems like you're just reporting mostly.
Right.
So,
right.
Again.
And I do feel like we have done a lot of that. As you will see, we have, at the program level, the documentation that is required to get through stage gate 1, 2, 3, that sort of thing. It is lengthy, but I'm happy to say that we are making progress. I believe at the program level, we have one document left to achieve stage gate 2, and that is being, I think it's under review right now, so we're very close. The program schedule, the overall program schedule, has been baselined, so at least we can see the overall milestones, major milestones that we'll see throughout this program. For the employer programs project, Mary Michelle will be giving a pretty good update on that. We do have four alternatives that project team is looking at for the UAL resolution program, and the business case has been completed with a recommendation, so we'll be looking at that. I think the positive note about that is not only was the employer incentive fund very, very successful, but we've also been given an opportunity with an alternative we hadn't even considered. So, and that is meetings with CalPERS, they have offered us to look at their tool and possibly use that. So that's one of the alternatives that we are looking at as well, and would be a much lower cost item than the some of the others from the vendors. So that's one thing that we have, we're considering. On the salary limits project, we have actually deployed not only Work Package 1, but Work Package 2 now, and they are looking at what their long-term vision is and really trying to finalize the actual requirements for Work Package 3 and 4. So that project's going very smoothly and is in the green. Work After Retirement, they are also looking at their long-term schedule. I would say this one, although it seemed fairly simple, has very big impact on our system because it's connected to our employer reporting, invoicing, gathering the contributions. So it really impacts our general ledger and accounting. So the first couple iterations are really just on the employer reporting, but it's that general ledger side where we have to allocate and account for all the contributions is the heavier lift. So that one, they're really trying to figure out what the scope is for that long term, the end of that project. On member redirect, and both of those, salary limit and work after retirement, they're non-stage gate projects, but we have been given endorsement to go forward on both of those with the Enterprise Information Services endorsement. So
can
that's a good thing.
Can you clarify that? What is the meaning of non-stage gate projects?
Meaning they have less, probably less documentation required, really, And so they're not as a heavy lift going forward through the, all the stage gate. So as we've been reporting out, we have had an analyst in our project office working hand in hand with us to help approve a lot of the documentations. And they felt that salary limits and work after retirement didn't rise to that level of true stage gate process where we had to have approval before we started any construction or development. And so for member redirect, that is a stage gate project. And for that one, we have reached stage gate two approval. We did have to start construction. We just started construction this week, so we, that is going forward. We were kind of at a very stressful time where we needed to start development or we may not have hit our expected deployment date. So we really worked hard to get that through with our EIS analyst.
Actually, if I may just make a comment, there is attachment 7 here, which says that salary limits and work after retirement sub-projects are proceeding without attendant approvals from EIS. So what? How can you connect that to the statement you made about?
So
are they not connected at all?
We just received the endorsements this week, so it could have been a timing.
Okay.
Like I said, every day we are new things are happening, but we do have the appropriate endorsements for those now.
Perfect. Yeah. Wonderful.
And so for the member redirect project, I did want to give you an update on where we're at with voluntary contributions. So on the member redirect, really member redirect is comprised of redirecting the IAP contributions, but also equally as large is a member electing to make voluntary contributions to make up that 2.5% or 0.75% of the redirected contributions. That we did meet with our external stakeholders, the governor's office, the Enterprise Information Services, the state CIO, that those stakeholders to really review where we had challenges of meeting the June 30th deployment or deadline for that portion of the bill. And we have come to, or we gave them our proposal that was for a deployment, for a member actually electing and the employer participating in, we would be able to do that by September 30th. We will try to manage some sort of retroactive ability for a member to go back to July 1 to participate in that so they don't lose that benefit if they so choose to do that. We haven't figured out exactly all of the processes that will be impacted by that and what would be more manual or maybe outside of our system to get that done, but that is our what we're shooting for. And so while that won't be deployed by June 30th, we will certainly try to make sure that a member has that opportunity from July going for at least for that time period. If we can at least get it in this year, then tax, it won't impact any taxes or anything like that. So that's our goal. And the team is working very hard to make sure technically we can do this. So even looking at breaking that up into work packages as well to make it easier on our developers to start getting some development done. And then member choice, that project started off a little later. One of the bigger decisions that was made was just exactly how we were going to handle member elections. And we had originally, when this bill was passed, we had been envisioning that Voya would be doing a lot of the assistance in that area and a separate microsite, that sort of thing, where our members would go to make the selection. We have now decided to look at our current online member system where a member would log on to our PERS site and their online member site and make that election in that system, which would benefit there are several things that members, we have a lot of members that never log in to our online member system. So this would help push that membership up and awareness and actually give us some of the control to be able to manage the data. We wouldn't be as reliant on Voya to reconcile that. So those are just the high-level, some updates on the projects. I wanted to call out on the second page of my memo, it's just some high-level activities. One of the big things that has recently happened this week is we received the initial risk assessment from Gartner, who is our external quality management vendor. And no surprises, there were a lot of things that were called out. One example would be that we didn't have the program schedule completed. You know, we really needed to get that done. Well, that is something that we are trying to finalize for every project. And at a minimum, we've at least got the program schedule now baselined. But some other things that they noticed and kind of were their findings was we lack some of depth in our organizational change management area, and they recommend us to actually bring on like another resource. But really, the area that we are hadn't gotten to yet, it wasn't that we weren't planning on doing it, we just hadn't gotten there yet, is on the identifying all the new business processes and the changing business processes to really categorize them so that you can then look at training and other resources that we need to bring on to make sure that our staff understand what's going to be happening. So those are things that we'll be looking at in addition to all the findings that they and the recommendations they have. We'll look at developing responses for those and really identifying what we're going to do to mitigate those risks. But really no surprises. I think in the enterprise information services memo for the budget memo, they said that we were behind the curve even before the project started, because the first deadline was July 1 of 2019, right when we started. So, you know, this has been challenging, but I think at least what I can see, we are making progress every week. For staffing, we have three critical positions that we still haven't filled, although we've made an offer to a staff person so that one of them will be hopefully joining us soon. We have interviews scheduled for the business rules positions next week. We are also looking at, for the rest of the operational positions, not all of them, but there's a couple that we may actually decide to not fill, because when we came up with our fiscal analysis, and it was just a shot in the dark in some areas of let's make sure this area has resources, and actually looking at the work, we may decide that we don't really need that, which is okay. At least we had that option to look at that. And so those that I would expect in our next board presentation, you might see some information about that if we have made that decision to not fill some of the positions.
So that of the 37 positions, mm-hmm. or 43 as you mentioned, mm-hmm. how many do you have filled, either with internal staff or externally?
There have been about probably five that we have filled with an internal workout of class, mm-hmm. meaning we didn't actually fill them through recruitment and that person moved in. So then the challenge is backfilling them on the operational side. But we have brought on quite a few new staff externally. I don't have all the numbers. I know we've also had some internal staff move into the limited duration position, and then at the end of the project, they would we would have to go through a process where we move them back or have a bumping process back into permanent positions. But the sheer number of vacancies, I think, in our operations section we're still at about 35 vacancies because of all of the staff movements into either project work or some of our other vacancies. So it's an enormous amount of work that our human resources section is taking on right now. That's why you haven't seen huge changes in our numbers, because we're just trying to work through the priority, the ones that we have priority on. And some of the managers did not really need the positions to start until, say, the first of the year. They really wanted to target them, like our call center representatives. We're gearing up for member annual statements and member choice, which are happening later on this year. So get them in to get good training, and then they'll be ready on the phones for that time period. As you saw in our budget, in attachment A2C, we had a budget slide on where we're at with Senate Bill 1049 budget spending. It is, we've tried to project as much as we can, and it shows about a $2 million variance. That will change as we really define some of the long-term solutions, which in member redirect and perhaps in member choice, we just aren't positive yet on. The member choice budget had quite a big budget for this the external vendor, so are using Voya, so some of that might be worked out, are subject to change. We continue to meet with our external stakeholders monthly and weekly. We are really trying to fine-tune the budget reporting. Our legislative fiscal office has continued to give us feedback on what they would like to see, as well as our DAS, Chief Financial Office Analyst, you know, what would she like to see? So we're really trying to make sure our reporting hits all of those audiences and as useful as it can be. So I hope we're continuing to get better in that area. In communications, I'm not sure if you were able to see this, but we had an article published in My Oregon News, which is the governor's news resource, I guess, and it was published this week on the success of the Employer Incentive Fund. It was very well written and really nice, kind of a kudos, you know, and a nice to see the one of our parts of this project having some recognition for being successful. On the member side, we are still working on targeting. We have a lot of gov delivery emails that we either send out to employers or members regarding any of these updates. We had our December edition of the perspectives with a lot of the updates. And I wanted to just point out in our April edition of our perspectives, in around April, we will be deploying 3 videos that really try to explain the individual account program to our members and how, what's target date funds, how is member redirect going to work? Because on a lot of fronts, member redirect won't be that obvious to members right away. I mean, they're from an employer reporting perspective, employers aren't going to have to change anything. We're going to be splitting off those funds into the pension stability account, and the rest of the money will be going into their IEP. So they won't see those changes right away, but really trying to make them understand what that means to them. What is the IEP? Be looking for that, and I'll make sure we link to those things in our next board presentation. And then as you can see, we attached our full budget note, many, many, many pages. And I actually did not have much hand in writing that. It was mostly Kevin, Marjorie, others really pulling that together, So as well as our budget folks. But I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Chair Shanoi, thank you. With your forbearance and the board's forbearance, I have both comments and questions. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to start by reading a paragraph from the budget note you just, the budget report you just made. On page 13, there's a section headed Agency Change Fatigue. Second paragraph, with approval of SB 1049, including aggressive mandated implementation dates, we are now stretched to, and in some areas, beyond the fatigue wall from which will take some time to recover. We are initially creating solutions to meet legislative directives. This is not a logical or cost-effective method to improve functionality of our antiquated technology, improve services to more than 900 public employers, or serve as a retirement system to more than 375,000 members. So as a board member, I want to be on the record as being complete support of that statement by the director, and I want PERS employees to know that I fully respect their heroic efforts to carry out this impossible task. They've been given mandates that are not possible to meet. You've mentioned a couple of them, and at the expense of meeting their core function and the reasons. I'm sure the reasons that they signed up to be PERS employees for the mission they carry that they to carry out. Mm-hmm. Because of the other position I hold, I happen to be aware that this is having a negative impact on employee morale. I can't help but wonder if that's having an impact on the agency's ability to fill some of these internal positions, including some of the LD positions, some duration positions, even after you straighten out the return to work issues. You, as an example, you cite the fact that the redirect isn't going to affect before the employee's ability to make voluntary contributions to make themselves whole isn't going to affect. You mentioned that there's a possibility of zeroing out the tax effect. Is there? I didn't have a time limit where they can make up that money, those 2 months, 2 or 3 months, where they don't have the voluntary contribution?
Chair Shinoy, Board Member Demarest, that is our goal, is to, even if we're deploying any automated feature, however we're going to be doing that, if it's effective after July 1, we will have to be able to allow an employee to elect and an employer to withhold the monies to make that up. So that's our goal. I'm not sure exactly how it will work, but the idea is if we can get it effective this year, then because they're after-tax contributions, we want to make sure we're not going to be impacting the and having to make up or change anything in the prior year or the following year.
Well, my point, tell me if I'm off track, but if they don't have the ability to make these redirect or make up these voluntary contributions until September 30th, and they need to do it in this calendar year, then for state employees and higher ed employees that are paid once a month, that's just a couple paychecks left in the year. Mm-hmm. I don't know how feasible that is for a lot of people to do that. And again, I'm not laying, this isn't PERS fault. They're doing the best they could, but it's a disservice to the agency. It's a disservice to PERS members that they're in that situation. There's multiple references in here to MVPs, minimum viable products. Is it accurate to say that a minimal viable product is a workaround until a permanent solution is found or implemented?
Chair Shinoy, Board Member Demarest, for some of these, for example, salary limits, the minimum viable product was really just to have a report for our employer service center staff to be able to monitor whether a member was reaching that limit, so that we would be able to then communicate to the employer that they needed to change their contributions withheld on that dollar amount. So That is similar to what we've been doing with other scenarios with the IRC limits that we've had in place already. We would reach out to employers to let them know, hey, this member's hitting their limit. So in some cases, an MVP is a manual workaround. For the work after retirement, the MVP was really to stop the retiree wages that were coming in just from a data perspective, because that's all we were getting at the time, we are getting, so that we can then put out a new wage code and we wouldn't have to clean up 6 months worth of contribution wages. And so in some cases, the MVP, it may be a manual workaround, it may be something just to be the first step to get us to full automation. I don't think any are throwaway or anything like that. We're really trying to build upon whatever that first step is to then do. So for salary limits, we've already deployed two deployments, and they're just building on each other.
All right. Thank you. And again, I appreciate everyone's forbearance.
I would like to point out one final thing about voluntary contributions. We have been partnering and trying to work and keep employers in the loop, as well as collaborating with them on what this could be, how can we manage any type of retroactive payments or election from members. So we had our EAG meeting on January 17th. We have asked for employers that are interested in helping us define requirements for that process. And so that hopefully will help alleviate in the retroactive side. I think we also struggle with how does voluntary contributions work just going forward, you know, even if we didn't have to deal with the retroactive side. So we're really looking at those in two parts. But I think that employer input will be very valuable.
Thanks, Yvette.
I think even when the Senate bill was passed, I think the agency realized that no matter how many heads you give the agency or how much budget you give the agency, the disturbance it's going to cause to operations is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And just hearing you say that there are 35 open positions in operations is the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
So there are a lot of reasons why some of these projects are in the yellow. And, you know, you've cited very many reasons, schedule creation delays, staffing issues. Rather than going into details of projects, I think I would ask both you and Director Olenek to just overall say which are the biggest problem areas that you're facing. And as a board, how can we support you? How can we help? And I'm reiterating what Director Demarest has said, that this are truly heroic mm-hmm. efforts. I mean, mm-hmm. not only are you continuing on with your regular work, but this is a huge project on top. Mm-hmm. So how can we support? And what are your major pain points?
Chair Chenoy, I think the couple that we have right now are really, and I don't know how you can help with this because it has to do with time, right? We're beating the drum to a June 30th deadline for example, for member redirect. So I believe at this point we're doing all we can do. I think we have the right people on board. We are actually also partnering with EIS to bring in a couple additional resources just to fill some of the gaps on, for example, for myself, I've never run or been a sponsor of such a large project. And having grown up at PERS, not been exposed to how maybe an external resource or contractor would have done it in some of the bit larger companies. So having someone come in and help identify gaps, you know, where we could be doing things differently, better, that sort of thing, would be really helpful. So we're working at bringing on those kinds of resources. But I think, you know, overall, I think we are doing the right things.
To add to that, Chair Chenoy, I look at this as a flywheel effect right now, where the first few turns around a flywheel take a lot of time and effort to get rolling. But as the flywheel starts to move, you gain momentum and start to get things done. And we're at that point now where the flywheel is starting to move with greater acceleration and momentum. Mm-hmm. We've got a lot of very good people internally here. We're bringing in external resources to help. The biggest challenge to Yvette's point is time. We can't suspend time and say, could you give us a month? When you start a project of this magnitude, typically if it's of your doing, you have a significant time to plan and ramp up. And we do not have what I would call excess resources. We've never had excess resources waiting on the sidelines to jump in and do this. And so the initial ramp up time does take a significant amount of time and effort, and the documentation that we needed to put into place to move ahead took a lot of effort. I'm comforted by how we're progressing, and quite honestly, that risk assessment that was done by Gartner showed that we are doing quite a few things well, but there are also opportunities. So we're building on what we're doing well and trying to fill those gaps as quickly as possible and things that we need to do. For instance, the scheduling and budgeting, which is substantively complete in the last 2 or 3 weeks. There is a lot of effort yet to do to make sure that we've built out the elaborations. If you look at your board packet, I think it's attachment 2 on 100, page 112, 164, the implementation roadmap, mm-hmm. you will see that we've articulated the various work packages and work streams, and there is a lot of work there, and there's further Gantt charts and project charts behind that to show what the critical paths are. And it is the compressed time frame that we are dealing with that gives us some anxiety. Mm-hmm. That said, we are doing heroic efforts, and I'm very proud of what we've done to date and will do going forward. This does give us, as with everything, a wonderful opportunity to continue to mature our organization and build out those competencies and capabilities that we'll need going into the future. So the staff are rallying around. We have been getting very good support from our stakeholders, be it the governor's office, be it DAS, Enterprise Information Services, all of those areas, to help us set us up to succeed as much as possible. And in some cases, we will have to delay, like voluntary contributions, but we'll, to Yvette's point, we've been working very collaboratively with the employers to find out ways of making sure they can help us and making sure that we actually assist them in their implementations. And for instance, there are some employers right now who are what we call push employers that actually push money. So for those people who are retirees, they're actually pushing money to us already, and we'll have to go in and account for it appropriately. I expect we can probably do some of the similar things with voluntary contributions to mitigate that gap. Mm-hmm. But it is a challenge. Our staff are rising to the challenge, and the momentum is increasing every day. And so I'm very proud of where we're at. Would we like to be further ahead? Absolutely. Everybody would, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But we are where we're at, and making substantive progress on a daily basis towards getting this into place within the mandated timelines.
And how is the communication with DAS and LFO and other legislative bodies? Are they responsive to?
Very. Okay. Chair Shenoy, we, as I stated, we actually have a 8 a.m. weekly call with DAS, DAS Procurement, and the Enterprise Information Services, just to keep those lines open, and then a monthly call with the Governor's Office, Katie Koba, Terrence Woods, the state CIO, just to make sure they're all in the loop, and I think Kevin meets even more regularly with them. So really, I do feel they've given us support, and even with the suggestion of other resources, can also, from their perspective, identify our gaps where we may not see them. So that's also been very helpful.
Two other points. One is everything that you have to do with the knowledge that you may have to roll it back. So that's a very pessimistic comment, but it's a true comment. And the last comment is, by the time we are done with this, we'll be in the 21-23 legislative session, and God knows what else is going to get thrown our way. So on that positive note, I'll ask my fellow board members if there are any other comments, or can we move on?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mary Michelle?
Yes.
I like your reports. It's very positive. Just a good.
I was going to say, now for something simple. Chair Shinoy, members of the board, Mary Michelle Sosny, actuarial business specialist. And as I said, employer programs is going very well and very simple. Not a lot has changed from my last report in December, so just some minor updates for the Employer Incentive Fund. We had two employers effectively rescind their applications. Basically, it was a no response. They just didn't make their payments. Just so you're aware of the process, at least a week in advance, I contact all employers before their payment is due. They can change their payment date up to 5 days before their intended payment date, so I try and give them enough time to let me know if they want to make that change. In this case, these employers didn't respond. I still contact them on their due date just to make sure nothing catastrophic happened. There's just no response from these two. So the EIF matches that they had were given to the last approved EIF employer, and since they didn't receive a full match, and that was $212,500. And then we had another employer reduce their lump sum payment, and so we have a almost $45,000 in the EIF fund now that will go to the first employer on the wait list, and that's Multnomah County. And the next big payment period will start at the end of June and then roll through August. So that's when we anticipate, if there are any other additional changes, that's when we'll likely start to see those. And then I will focus more on the Senate Bill 1566 reporting, which includes some updates for EIF as well. We're required to report to Ways and Means on an annual basis on the status of the School District's Unfunded Liability Fund, the Employer Incentive Fund, and the UAL Resolution Program. All of these programs were created with Senate Bill 1566 in 2018. Some of them were modified in 1049 in 2019. The school district's unfunded liability fund is intended to create a side account for the school district's pool once it has enough revenue to fund a side account for the entire school district. Right now, we are only receiving funds from unclaimed property from state lands. So last year, we received a transfer of $11.5 million, and it earned interest of $232,000. We just received a payment of just over $21 million from Department of State Lands. We won't be receiving revenue from the other sources that are intended for the school district's unfunded liability fund this biennium, but we anticipate receiving it next biennium. And that's just how the statute was written, that they won't be transferred this biennium. And there won't be enough funds available to create a side account for the school districts this year if we don't anticipate making that transfer. What I do want to highlight for the for EIF is just the updated report on scoreboard. We have two sources of revenue for the Employer Incentive Fund outside of the $100 million appropriation for this year, and that's Oregon Lottery scoreboard, or the betting revenue, and then repatriated income from 1529. The 15 repatriated income from 1529 was estimated to be about $25 million. And the Oregon Lottery or Oregon Scoreboard revenue, as you can see, has been estimated all over the place. But as of November 30th, as reported by Oregon Lottery, they had just over $22.5 million reported, so I expect that those will be a lot higher numbers than originally estimated. And then for the Unfunded Actuarial Liability Resolution Program, Yvette spoke about the tools that we're considering, but we're also going to have some employer focus groups, and we have 23 employers who have volunteered. All but one of those came from the Employer Incentive Fund, so it's nice to see that the employer incentive fund and these programs are encouraging ongoing employer engagement. And we'll be using this group to help us set a baseline for employer knowledge of employer rates, and what kind of education they need from us, or to how they would need education repackage to better understand long-term budgeting and long-term forecasting. And then they will also be reviewing the whatever tool we do pick to make sure that it meets their forecasting needs and their funding plan needs. Any questions?
Thank you.
Told you. All right.
Thank you. Earnings crediting.
Good morning. Chair Shinoy, members of the board, Richard Horsford, Chief Financial Officer at PERS.
Chair Shinoy, members of the board, Amanda Marble, Financial Reporting Manager.
Before we get into the earnings crediting, I'd like to address earlier in the director's report, board member Buckley had asked a question about the health insurance costs. I wanted to verify that Kevin's brief answer was correct. We no longer have a reinsurance funds flow through that are effectively pass-through funds, so that was an expected change, and we'll continue. Today we're looking at the preliminary earnings crediting and reserving report. Under Oregon statute, we're required to submit a preliminary proposal to the appropriate legislative committees at least 30 days prior to making a final decision on earnings crediting. In here on page 2 of the report, which is page 149 of your packet, is a table describing the various earnings crediting that are generally dictated by both statute and rule. So today we are asking the board to approve earnings crediting as submitted. The very last one, the contingency reserve, does not have any earnings crediting as it's reached the maximum available by rule.
So most of these are either non-discretionary or directed by rule.
That is correct.
Well, it's good to see the numbers this year, especially as compared to last year. Very happy about that. Any questions from the board?
I'd move adoption of the earnings crediting.
Preliminary earnings crediting, yes. Right.
Second.
If there are no more questions, then all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Short and sweet. Thank you so
much. Short and sweet
again.
We're not completely resistant to feedback from board members and staff. So good morning, everyone. I'm Matt Larrabee with Milliman in the Portland office.
I'm Scott Peppermeyer with Milliman.
And compared to some of the topics that have preceded it, yes, what we have today is rather short and sweet, because if you don't like valuation estimates, why not updates? You know, some updates to estimates. So we've only got 4 slides to present today now that we, as was just covered, we know what the preliminary earnings are for the calendar year 2019, very important year since the asset levels as of the end of last year will determine the calculated contribution rates for the 2021 to 2023 biennium. Also cognizant that Director Olenek and the agency have a trademark on a forward-looking calendar. We have a backward-looking calendar listed here. So in case anybody was lucky enough to miss it in October, we presented system-wide results of our advisory valuation based on where assets and liabilities were at the end of 2018. Then back in December, we came back with those advisory employer-specific rates. Those were, again, were based on where assets were at the end of 2018. Of course, a lot had already happened that we knew about on the asset side during calendar year 2019, so we also projected long-term financial modeling, so basically contribution rates in UAL over a 20-year span, reflective of what we knew of assets at that time, which was through the end of the third quarter. We had posted nearly a plus 10% return. However, today we're back. We had a good fourth quarter on the investment side. It was nearly a plus 4% additional in Q4 in dollar terms. That is in excess of $2 billion to the good,
which is excellent news. So we are presenting updates of a couple of key metrics that folks tend to focus on based on where we think things will end when we publish our December 31, 2019 report. That's not going to happen for another couple quarters, to give as early as possible a preview of where we think UAL and system average rates will be.
I have to say that this slide really confused the heck out of me, because I didn't read backward-looking calendar. I just read October, December. I'm like, wait, what am I missing? Which year am I in? So.
I should have. I've been discouraged from using clip art anymore, but maybe I should have put a rear view mirror image up in the top here somewhere, Chair Shenoy. So slide 204. There's the number that Ms. Marble always spoke about, 13.56% for the year. Key metric we always focus on, and a lot of other interested parties do as well, what is the UAL excluding site accounts? When we completed our end of 2018 valuation, that was at $27 billion. Our current estimate now is $24.1 billion, with funded status excluding site accounts year over year, improving by 4% from 69 up to 73. Up on the right-hand side of this graphic, we do have a significant amount of existing unamortized site accounts. If we look at the UAL and the funded status, including those, we see about a $19 billion UAL, 79% funded status. Important point on the second bullet of this slide is that these site accounts reflected in this estimate do not include the new accounts established during 2019, including the effect of the Employer Incentive Fund program. So those numbers will, those including site account figures, will materially move between this estimate and our final results later on this year. Okay, so turning from UAL and funded status to rates, this is a graphic we try to continually update. It tries to show over the span of time from the last rates that were set before the effects of the 2008 economic downturn. That's over on the far left. Those 2009 to 11 rates were the last ones before reflecting and having to deal with the effects of 2008. All the way off to the right, which is our current estimates of the rates for the 2021 to 2023 biennium. Those rates on the right reflect Senate Bill 1049. They reflect what we know about the actual 2019 investment returns. However, they are still dotted lines because they don't reflect the effects of the member census data as of 12/31/2019, although the effects that we have from census data tend to be rather light historically, because the behavior of the population in terms of turnover, mortality, salary increases is fairly predictable given the size of the Oregon PERS group. Important point of emphasis here, I've got this, tried to call more attention to it on the line up on the top where the underline and the little asterisk is and the little text down below. This chart shows what we refer to as total rates. So now that we have 1049 and we have member redirection in place starting in the 2021 biennium, the rates shown in this chart are the combined contribution rates, both employer plus estimated member redirect. What do we see here? That uncollared rate, which is the gray, we had that uncollared rate pop up quite a bit between 15-17 and 17-19. We note the reasons for that on the slide. We had the Morrow decision come in. That was a significant reversal and increase in the liabilities. We also had a poor investment year in 2015 that pumped up the UAL, in addition to a change in the assumed return. So we kind of had a triple whammy there. And then the collared rates, base and net, have kind of behaved the way you'd want collaring to expect, as the uncollared rate goes up and then the collared rates start to chase them. The chase ends is our projection in 2021-23. There's a couple reasons for that. 1049 undoubtedly has an effect. We had a good investment return this year. That was helpful. If you have a really sharp eye, you can see that those blue lines are going up just a tiny little bit despite the good returns, and that's really because those rates are going up at a total level. So even though we had a good investment return in 2019, we're still boosting up the total contribution rates to help shore up the funded status of the program and get it back to 100% systematically over time. So digging in on those far, the last two sets of rates, 1921 and our estimates for the upcoming 21 to 23 biennium, that uncollared rate dropped by nearly 3% of payroll. That is due to the effects of 1049, helped by the good returns in calendar year 2019. That total base rate, which is a collared rate, total contributions coming into the program between employer contributions, member redirect, and site account transfers from employer site accounts, that edged up slightly, less than 1% of payroll biennium over biennium as our estimate. Of course, we do have the member redirect coming in per Senate Bill 1049 at a system level. We estimate that's going to be about 1.3% of payroll. It's worth noting, and we've got this in the text on the slide, that that 1.3% of payroll weighting is based on where the payroll split is between Tier 1, Tier 2, and OPSERP right now as of the end of last year. So that number will probably edge down a little bit in practical effect when we get to July of 2021, when the payroll in the system is more heavily weighted towards OPSERP and less heavily weighted towards Tier 1, Tier 2. So looking at what the employers would pay, that's the fourth row in this table. Due to the member redirect and the decrease in the uncollared rate, the collared base rate, so this is what employers pay through their contributions and site account transfers at a system average level, is edging down a little bit by about 0.5% of payroll. Get the site account effects out of there, that's the collared net rate. That is moving down a little bit more, 0.7% of payroll. It moves down more than the base rate because the buzzword that we always use with site accounts is they are not arbitrage, they are leverage. They're a leveraged bet on the market. The market did well in 2019, so the employers benefit from that investment decision that they made. And quite remarkably, I have nothing more to say, but we'd be happy to entertain questions. I hope you enjoyed Scott's Penn and Teller routine with me.
You have anything you want to add?
Nope, I think you got it.
I don't think we can top this good news, so.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thanks.
Yeah. Anything else, Director Aldenick? Thank you so much, and meeting is adjourned.